Well, hello there, and welcome to True Crime Bones. With me, your host, Marissa, also known as Bones. And for today's episode, we're gonna do a bit of time traveling. Yes, so buckle up as we are going all the way back to the year 1956. Yep, you heard right, 1956. Going very old school with this one. Back to a time where things, especially South Africa, were very, very different. To look at the murder of 18-year-old Maynard Joy Aitken in what was known as the Van Buren case. But first, I would like to give a shout out and a huge thank you to Debbie for joining the True Crime Bones Patreon. Debbie also has a true crime podcast called The Right Shoe, as well as a true crime Instagram page at shopholicdeb44. I will be leaving the links in the episode description, as I definitely recommend checking them out. So welcome, Debbie, to the Bone Squad Skeleton Crew Patella Collection. I don't know yet. I'm still working on the name, but welcome. Also, if you would like to support this podcast and help me not only move up from this bathroom floor, but also making more, a lot more episodes with better quality, while getting some sweet, sweet, extra, exclusive, and behind the scenes content, then please consider becoming a True Crime Bones patron. Because with $1, you might not be able to change the world, but you can change this podcast and my life. So, if you'd like to check it out, the link is available in the episode description, as well as in the truecrime.bones Instagram page's bio. Now, with that being said, let's get into it. Maynard Joy Aitken, an 18-year-old girl from Pinetown, South Africa, was to have attended a dancing class on the evening of October the 2nd, 1956. So in preparation for the event, she put out the dress she was going to wear, and at 11 a.m., she telephoned her mother, Mrs. Isabel Aitken, to confirm the time she had to be there. Mrs. Aitken, Joy, and a friend had arranged to leave from home and arrive at the Durban studio of Mrs. Aitken's niece not later than 7:30 p.m. Joy left her home at 189 Old Main Road, Pinetown, at about 7:40 a.m. She carried with her some beetroot sandwiches her mother had prepared for her. Okay, beetroot sandwich, what? Like, until this case, I've never heard of beetroot sandwiches. I know what beetroot is, like beetroots, but on a sandwich, I don't even know people do that. Do people still do that? Is that a thing? Am I just out of the loop? Please, if the platform you are listening this on, if you're able to comment, leave a comment, please let me know if beetroot sandwiches is a thing. If so, how does it taste? And if you can't leave like a comment on the platform you're listening on, please let me know on Instagram. I feel like this is very important. I need to know, because my mind can just not comprehend it. Beetroot sandwiches, damn. Anyway. The last time Mrs. Aitken saw her daughter alive, she was wearing a red coat with a blue flower dress and blue shoes. When Joy did not come home that night, Mrs. Aitken became worried and telephoned the police at 9:50 p.m. An intensive search was instituted, and when, after several days, no trace of her could be found, it became nationwide news. But although Joy's body had not been found, detectives had an accurate description of the man with whom she had last been seen. Wanted for questioning In connection with the disappearance was a man aged 33, was about 5'9" tall, with straight, light brown hair, thinning at the temples, and with a wavy kink in front, and with an index finger of one of his hands that was stiff. Okay, now I know every detail is crucial and as much as you possibly can give, yes, I just find it. And it's the finger. Well, okay. Anybody ever be looking for me? Just be like, woman with crooked fingers. Because I've broken mine so many times, they are like the crookedest fingers ever. I think that is, yeah, the one with the crooked fingers. Anyway, sorry. The man, remember this, the finger, was last seen wearing a black double-breasted jacket and with grey flannel trousers. The description of the man was given by Miss E. Powdrell and Mrs. Charmaine Matthew, who both worked with Joy at British Motors in Smith Street in Durban. Miss Powdrell said that it was not the first time they saw him. On September the 28th, he came into the office and greeted Joy with words something like, and I quote, "Hello, Cookie," end quote. Mrs. Powdrell noticed that her friend was very upset. Joy said something to the man, and when he left, she was on the verge of tears. She had spoken to him before, and spoken to me about him before as well, but she never mentioned the man's name, Mrs. Powdrell said. At 5 p.m. on October the 2nd, Miss Powdrell saw the man again. He was driving a beige-colored Ford Anglia. The car passed near her office, proceeded westward in Smith Street, and turned right into Ullevall Street. Sitting next to him in the car was Joy Aiken. Joy saw Mrs. Matthew and waved, and Mrs. Matthew waved back. I mean, why wouldn't she? That'd be bad manners. Earlier that day, between 4:30 p.m. and 5 p.m., Miss Powdrell later testified, Joy received a telephone call and seemed pleased to be getting a lift home. Yes, thank you very much, she said. B. Mrs. Matthew also heard the call. 7 days after her disappearance, no clue as to where she might have emerged. On the 8th day, Joy's brother Colin approached a medium, Mr. Nelson Palmer, a former Durban headmaster, through his son, Jack. The Palmers lived next door to the Aikens. Okay, now if your neighbors, or well, your neighbor, is a medium, why do you have to go and ask his son, like, can I talk to your father? Can we do the medium thing? Why just not, like, you know, he's your neighbor. But okay. The Palmer, or Mr. Palmer, a man with short graying hair, agreed to help the boy with his sister. Obviously, I mean, he's his neighbor. That would be like very unneighborly if he didn't. Seated in the room when Mr. Palmer went into a trance were his wife, son, his daughter-in-law, and Colin Aiken. Okay, again. I feel like that's like invasion of privacy or something, because Mr. Palmer and his whole freaking family be there, and just one person of the medical family members there, her brother. Again, well, the whole other family is there. Is it just me? Anyway, Mr. Palmer said Joy's body was lying about 60 miles away. Colin Aiken recalled, and I quote, "Go up the hill, down a hill, and up a hill, and on the other side you will find Joy. The position will be north of the coast, inland. She will be on the bottom side of a culvert, in about 3 or 4 feet of water," end quote. Now, really, up, you go up, you go down, you go up. How is a person supposed to like work with that? I'll be up, down, out. But for some, it worked somehow, because you know, they went to check, and because Mr. Palmer had certain sensitive and was sensitive to vibration and feelings and stuff like that, Mr. Palmer accompanied a search party to the spot where he predicted the body would be found. Okay, man, how do you know? Just tell me up, down, up, down. Huh? That could literally be like every place around me. But again, who am I to say anything? Because they found him. So when they reached the spot where Mr. Palmer predicted, Colin Aiken went with him as well. And they found the naked, mutilated body laying face downward in a culvert in the Umtalumi area. The discovery was immediately reported to the police. Again, it's a mad skills being able to use up, down to find someone. Detective Sergeant J.F. Petersher, the first policeman on the scene, did not have to look far to find a vital clue in the murder investigation. Near the wall of the culvert, he found a blood-stained visiting card with the name Globe Electric on it. He also discovered a blood-stained piece of material. A post-mortem examination of the body by Dr. Ian Robertson, a senior assistant pathologist in Durban, revealed several gunshot wounds in the head, a gunshot wound of the right wrist, and 11-inch long wound involving the right buttock. In the stomach, he found semi-solid food resembling pieces of beetroot. You know, it's like from the beetroot sandwich she had. It was impossible to say whether the girl had been sexually assaulted because parts of her lower body were missing. And that's just horrible. Death was due either to gunshot wounds of the head or to shock and hemorrhage of a large wound on the body, or both. The most ironical aspect of the murder was that the murderer, the Palmers, and the Aikens were neighbors, and that the murderer was arrested in the bush near the Pinetown police station, not far from where he lived. One newspaper said that he was captured within an area of less than a square mile containing the police station, the Palmer's house, and the Aikens' home. So basically, the place where the girl lived was murdered, the victim, the neighbor who helped find the body, and the mirror, all in the same area. I mean, what is the chances? Detective Constable H.A. van Dijk and other detectives were searching the bush near the police station when they saw a white man running towards a house. So he called on to the man to stop running because, you know, obviously when the man saw the police, he started running. And obviously when the detective held like, stop, he didn't stop. I don't know. Does anyone even in that situation stop? So, because the stop didn't help, the detective gave chase. And he fired his shot. Well, not like Adam trying to shoot him, but like as like a warning, and said again that he must stop. Obviously, the man didn't stop. So, the detective fired twice more. And again, the man didn't stop. He probably just ran faster. The man then disappeared around the house. The detective followed him through a gate. And this is, and I quote, what Detective Constable said, Van Dijk said during trial. I saw him again, end quote. Detective Constable Van Dijk subsequently testified, another quote. He had a gun in his hand and the gloves were off. End quote. That means when it's like the gloves are off, it's like now things are getting real. Quote again. Then he threw the gun into the air. I arrested and handcuffed him. End quote. Well, that sounds like it's so quick at the end. I mean, chasing, running, all that. Guy refuses, but then just quick. But hey. In mock surprise, the man inquired of the police, and I quote, "What are you people chasing me for? I didn't do anything," end quote. Well, you started running. I mean, like, obviously, they're going to chase you, and I'd take. Yeah. A crowd of people had gathered in front of the police station, and when they heard shots, they searched to the place where the man was being arrested. One of the people in the crowd was Joy's father, Mr. Fred Aiken. He and the arrested man exchanged words, and the police had to restrain him from getting too close, which is understandable. I would want to beat you too. Held in custody was Clarence Gordon van Buren, 33, a thrice married man with several previous convictions, including theft, forgery, and uttering. Being in possession of arms and ammunition, negligent driving, and escaping from custody. That man had a rap sheet as long as, I can't think of like a thing to say. Or, yeah. He's at the age of 17, he was convicted of car theft and sent to Tukai, a reformatory school. Jailed in Pretoria Central Prison, he decided that he should rehabilitate. There we go, rehabilitate himself. And so he studied electrical and mechanical engineering. His private life had been equally unhappy. I mean, if you look how many times he was in jail. But yeah. Van Buren maintained that his first wife left him after 6 weeks of marriage. I mean, damn. That is still like in the honeymoon phase. The amount of money you lost with that, whew. No. And his second marriage broke. We broke up when his wife's parents learned of his convictions. I mean, obviously. Okay. His marriage to his third wife. Like, after the second one, I'd be like, okay, I'm done now. Because I don't do it. But, hey, it worked for him. Because his third marriage with, well, his third wife, they were happy, actually. And they had two children. So, I mean, third time is a charm, like they say. At 4:50 p.m., on the day Van Buren was arrested, the investigating officer, Detective Sergeant Francois Steenkamp of the Durban CID, found the prisoner crying and terribly upset at the Pinetown police station. The detective stated that he warned him not to say anything, and that the reason being that there was a large crowd at the police station. You know, so here's this man crying and upset, like he would like say anything. And I mean, this detective is still like very nice, like, you know, your words can be held against you. So don't, not in this situation. So the detective even still tried to calm down, not to say anything until, you know, got a place, because the detective was anxious to get Van Buren away from there as quickly as possible, as he didn't want him, you know, Van Buren, to say anything that in the excitement of the moment he might have regretted later. You see, like, exactly. This guy was still nice. Like, shh, you know? Not now. Acting quickly, the police took Van Buren by van to the central police station. in Durban. Their captain, H. Oosthuizen of the CID, warned him that he had been arrested on suspicion of causing Joy Aiken's death, and that he need not say anything. Van Beeren agreed to answer questions. So it's like, you don't have to say anything. But it's like, I must spill the beans. Yeah? I mean, it's an easy case then. But, you know, things don't always work out like that. The following morning, in the presence of Captain Oosthuizen, the prisoner told the investigating officer, and I quote, "You can scratch that statement. It is a lot of bumpkin." End quote. You can see this is an old case. I haven't heard the word bumpkin in so many years. Again, Van Beeren was warned that he did not have to make a statement. But what's more, he agreed to make one, admitting everything. My hand's like, it's a bumpkin, but then let's do it. Let's admit everything. It's a confusing situation. He did say, "I must say, it is a hopeless situation. I cannot sleep and I cannot wink." What? I cannot sleep and I cannot wink. Okay, that is some unnecessary information. Can we get to the real thing? I mean, but that is his thing. The police took down another statement, but it was not completed because it was recorded as being in the nature of a confession. And obviously, I cannot sleep, I cannot blink. It's not useful. But then, once he had been told that he would have to make the statement to the magistrate, Van Beeren was taken to Mr. Aubrey Griffiths, an assistant magistrate. Sorry, I keep wanting to say the Afrikaans version, magistraat. This statement was taken down and later read out in court. So here's the next one, because that one made sense, the next one he did. Hopefully no blinking. And that one was the one that was used in court. In the statement, Van Beeren admitted that he had met Joy in front of Durban Post Office after 6 p.m. on October the 2nd. They drove to the Coogee Tea Room and parked the car near there on the Marine Parade. Now, this is a quote. I'm going to quote Van Beeren. "She was telling me that she was not happy at home with her father. I said, I have also got troubles of my own. Let us go and have a few drinks. She said that she did not feel like a drink, so I left her in the car with the ignition key in the ignition switch. I went to a bar, first round the corner from the beach hotel, but they were talking a lot of filth, so I went to the beach hotel, Verona." End quote. Okay. How do you just leave a person in the car? Okay, I'm going to go have my drinks. Who does that? Van Beeren told of spending almost an hour at the hotel and then returning to the car, finding it gone. He assumed that Joy had become annoyed and driven off. He decided to do some more drinking. Again, what? Soon after 10:30 p.m., he was not sure of the time. He spotted the car about 50 yards from where he had parked it. Van Beeren said, and I quote, "As I opened the front door, I saw there was something on the floor between front and back seat. I struck a match to see what it was. I saw it was Joy, and all her face was covered in blood." End quote. Van Beeren was in a terrific panic, and not knowing what to do, he felt a pulse and he felt no beat. After stopping for petrol at Nelson Garage in Bray Road, he drove to the south coast to make up his mind what to do. His mind was in a nervous state and he felt completely shot. He could not drive any farther. Van Buren stopped the car between Amanzimtoti and Mkomas. And while he was recovering from his drunken state, a policeman shone his torch through the driver's window and wanted to know what Van Buren was doing there. Van Buren replied that he was not feeling too good and was simply resting. Later that morning, he stopped for a cigarette and at a tea room outside Port Shepstone, and then drove down to the coast to a place past Margate where he stopped and tried to rest on the beach. In a state of collapse, he got back into his car and drove back towards Durban. His nerves by this time were bad and he was in need of a drink. The first place he found open was the Kraal Inn in Mthwalumi. At this stage, Van Buren had to make a decision. Where could he get rid of the body? He must have gone through a great deal of mental agony, for he left the bar twice, each time driving away with the car, but then coming back not long after, just to drink some more. Sometime after the day, he began worrying about his wife and children. I mean, that thing is what you worry about at that. Okay. At this point, he stopped his car near Mthwalumi Bridge and put the body in a culvert under the road. And then he drove off. 3 days earlier, on October 9th, a letter addressed to the investigating department of South African police in Pinetown was received by Head Constable Casper Now. The letter contained a statement written by Van Buren on October 7th. In the letter, he said that on October the 2nd, he gave Joy Aiken a lift to work. And at 5 p.m., he met her again. But when she saw he was under the influence of liquor, she became angry and asked to be dropped off at the post office. You see, that's why Mrs. Powdle saw him. And when she waved and waved back. So that was the reason she was upset that day. So that fits that description. Sorry about that. This is not a part two, and that was not a sign of the end of the episode. You know, my bathroom office was interrupted and some skillful editing. Yeah, because that's how we do it here. So let's get into it. The case against Van Buren was airtight. The police had taken possession of his car and found reddish brown stains on the ceiling covering above the front passenger seat. You know, that means blood. His movements on October 2nd before the murder was alleged to have taken, and what was alleged to have taken place the day following, it were established beyond all shadow of doubt. And witnesses could testify to that effect. It was not difficult to trace Van Buren's whereabouts on those 2 days. He had left a trail, basically like a sign saying, "This is what I'm doing, where I am." So easy. No murderer could have been more careless than Van Buren. The trial opened on February 11th, 1957, before Mr. Justice Broom, the judge president of Natal, with two assistants, Mr. H.V.L. Bizzell, Queen Counsel, and Mr. A.C. Warner from the Queen Counsel. Mr. R. Evelyn Wright from Queen Counsel, Attorney General of Natal with him, Mr. G.G. Lynn, appeared for the Crown, and Mr. J.S. Henning, instructed by Livingston, Dahl, and Winterton for Van Buren. Now, just so you know, because this case was back like in 1957, the justice system was known as the Crown. And since technically South Africa was still part of the Commonwealth back then. So, yeah, that's why the Crown. Because when I started researching, I'm like, what do they mean with the Crown? But now we know. So that aside, the public galleries were packed to capacity, as the Attorneys General outlined the Crown's case. The first principal witness to be called by the Crown was Mrs. Isabel Aiken, mother of the murdered girl. Given evidence seated in the well of the court, she told the judge and assessors that her daughter was a very happy girl. She said, and I quote, "She and her father had their little quarrels, but nothing much," end quote. Asked if she knew the man in the dock, Van Buren, Mrs. Aiken said that she had met him several times in the off-sales apartment of the Rockpie Hotel. Mrs. Aiken worked there and she knew Van Buren as a customer. Van Buren had twice visited the Aiken's house to repair a radio, and Joy was present on both occasions. Van Buren was just like an acquaintance at that time, as the acquaintanceship between Joey and Van Buren did not ripen into anything more, and Mrs. Aiken had no reason to suppose it did. And she didn't think there would be more, obviously, because he's married and he has two children. And she's 18. Okay, now back then things are different, but stop. When she was shown a stained blue flowered dress, Joy's mother was asked if it was the dress her daughter was wearing on October the 2nd. Mrs. Aiken nodded and then started sobbing quietly. There was a long pause while she collected herself. At the end of the Attorney General examination, she again broke down. I mean, this is expected. If you don't, I mean, you don't have feelings. The counsel for the defense, Mr. Henning, opened his cross-examination with a question about Mrs. Aiken's first meeting with Van Buren. She replied that it was before Christmas 1955. Van Buren and his family lived diagonally across the road from her house and she had once visited his wife at her flat. Turning to the other matters, Mr. Henning apologized and then asked, Is the fact that there was a lot of unhappiness in your home, is it a fact? She replied with, "There was not a lot of unhappiness." The judge then asked, "Was there any unhappiness at all?" She replied with, "Slight trouble and strain." Mr. Henning then asked, "Was it going on for some time? A few months?" She replied with, "Yes, before Joy's disappearance." Taking another line of questioning, counsel asked, "Did Joy have many friends?" She said, "Not many." "Did you meet them?" "No, not at all." "Were you a very strict parent?" "Yes, very." A part of questioning is done. I was just like, she's strict, very, but she doesn't know the rest. That's not strict. A strict parent would be like knowing everything. But as each Crown witness gave evidence, the weight of testimony against Van Buren became formidable. The evidence taken with the statements he made sealed his fate. Even when he himself took the stand and gave an explanation of what had happened on the night of the murder, there was no doubt what the final verdict would be. The day after counsel for the defense and the Crown had addressed the court, the judge president, Mr. Justice Broom, and his two assessors reached a verdict. Because we don't have a jury system, even back then. 15 seconds after they entered the Durban Supreme Court on February the 26th, 1957, at 10 a.m., Van Buren was sentenced to death for the murder of Joy Aiken. There were no this is going to be the sixth time recording this part, and I just can't with this word. Extenuating circumstances. Why does English have to be so hard for me sometimes? Huh? So, again, back then, we still had the death penalty. We don't have the death penalty anymore. So, yeah, with the extenuating circumstances, there was nothing like to, you know, prolong the situation. Back then, it was still like cut and dry. Done, executed like in the same year. Unlike now, when I see like people be on death row, they die of natural causes. Yeah, yeah. Well, back then, it's done. You know, Van Buren had nothing to say. He dazedly shook his head, his face contorted, and he whispered, "I have said all I have to say in court. I have said all I can say." Well, what more can you say? So, Van Buren's story was that he found the body in his car, and after stripping it, he had hidden it in a culvert. He denied killing the girl or causing any wounds. If his explanation might reasonably be true, he would be entitled to an acquittal. Logically, testing the evidence, the judge president examined Van Buren's testimony point by point. Would it have been reasonable for him to have left a girl of 18 who had asked for a lift home alone in the car on the beach for an hour while he went drinking by himself? That's my same question as well. Like, I agree with that. When he got back and found the car gone, would he have spent the next 3 hours drinking alone at various places? Again, this man is asking the right questions. And when he found her in the car with her head covered in blood, would he not have done almost anything other than what he did? Fourthly, would Van Buren not have done a great deal more to satisfy himself that the girl was really dead? And would he have stopped at Nelson Garage, where he was known to fill up his car with petrol, with a dead body in the back? These were some of the questions the court had to consider. It also had to consider whether it was credible for the unknown killer, if it wasn't now Van Buren, to have driven the car away and then driven it back to near the spot from where he had taken it. You know, like, okay, you see, if he didn't murder her, why didn't he say anything at the garage or say anything when the police shone the light on him, ask him if he's okay or not? And yes, if there was now another person, why in the hell would they drive the car back? No type of criminal would do that. None. So, in weighing up the probabilities of Van Buren's story, which, you know, I call bullshit on, the judge and his assessors did not overlook the large quantity of liquor he consumed on October the 2nd, and his own peculiar temperament, as far as the court had been able to judge it. I mean, he had no emotion. He was like, nope. Even after considering the numerous emotional distresses under which he said he was living, the court found his story grossly improbable. I mean, if it was back then, they didn't have slang, but I mean, I could just think the judge would be like, nah, now, no, don't be coming with me with that. But anyway, whether Van Buren had committed the murder beyond all reasonable doubt had to be decided on the evidence before the court. The first feature of the murder to be examined was the mutilation of the body. In the view of the court, the probabilities were that they were inflicted by the murderer and not by wild animals, as had been suggested in cross-examination. You know, like, no animals, but like, people are so easy to like, it's animals. No. Anyway, but the probabilities were not strong enough to eliminate all reasonable doubt. I mean, like, seriously, how can you still blame animals for that? There was no evidence on why Miss Aiken should have been murdered. You know, like, the reason why did he not... She was not sexually assaulted. Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, bottom part of her is missing. But no reason to let up human, like, no motive. No nothing. So that's also one that, like, kind of threw them off. The post-mortem disclosed no sign of struggle or, you know, obviously sexual assault because they couldn't. But Van Buren had signs of scratches. These could have been made, inflicted while he was dragging the body through the bushes. The evidence pointing to Van Buren as the murderer was that he was the last person seen by Miss Aikens shortly before her death. That he disposed of her body, her clothes and effects to prevent early identification. That she was killed by gunshots, of which at least one was a 0.22 copper-coated bullet, and that Van Buren had in his possession at the time a 0.22 automatic and copper-coated ammunition. I mean, the smoking gun. The shots were fired from Mrs. Aiken's right, and there were marks rubbed off the ceiling of Van Buren's car, which showed that these were consistent with him sitting in the driver's seat and firing towards the passenger seat. No bullet marks were found in the car, though. Basically, gunshot residue there, but no, like, maybe the car, like, window was open. So, the only interference the court could reasonably draw was that Van Buren murdered Miss Aiken. The circumstances of the actual killing remained a mystery. So, you know, no, definitely murdered her, but why? No one knows why. What probably occurred was that the murder took place before 8 p.m. and that the body was not in the car when Van Buren filled up at the garage. Having filled up, Van Buren picked up the body where he left it and set off down to the south coast and dropped it there. Van Buren was refused and leave to appeal against the verdict and the sentence. So basically, like, no, you ain't getting nothing, no, you staying in prison, man. No, going nowhere. Right up until the end, he repeatedly said, and not just said, he's went on like stating constantly and made sure that his declaration of innocence was heard. Which, when you go about the evidence, I think he'd be lying. Why wouldn't, I mean, a lot of, like, you know, ridiculous. Ted Bundy was like, I'm innocent up until late. Before, you know, I'm innocent until then. Not all killers be like, oh, no, I'm, I did it. It doesn't happen, so. He could have declared it either way. He's guilty. So on the morning of his execution, his last words were that he hoped the real murderer would suffer forever from a bad conscience. If there was another person, which I doubt, I really, really doubt, that's a good thing. Maybe haunted by his conscience. Clarence Gordon Van Buren died on the gallows at Pretoria Central Prison on Monday, June the 10th, 1957. You see, back then, quick, you know, same year of the trial, found guilty, no time wasted. Sent, hanged. And that's it. Well, we don't have the death penalty anymore. I'd like to know you guys' opinion on the death penalty. Are you for it? Not for it? What do you think? And that's it. This is surprisingly a long episode. I did not expect this to be so long. I am, because I'm trying to keep it short for you guys, you know, entertaining, hopefully. But, thank you. for listening. And this was the case of the Van Buren. And if you made it till the end, you are absolutely legendary. And once again, I would just like to thank Debbie for being a patron. And if you, listener, would like to see and hear more episodes, because I would love to produce more content, better quality, not be interrupted like on the bathroom floor like constantly, and because I've got much more to share. And with my page, the Instagram page, truecrime.bones, the news, the information there, and unfortunately I can't do it without you guys' help. So if you are able, there's like 4 options on my Patreon. First, I'm starting at $1, because man, even $1 would help. Every bit helps, so I can continue making better content if you guys want that and are willing and able to support me. So yes, on the Patreon, the tiers, you always get a shout out. There's so many different options and so much you get. Also, if you want, I'll include some cat photos. And if you really want to hear that chicken that always interrupts the recording, I'll show you that chicken, but only on Patreon. But thank you so much for listening. You guys are amazing. Without you, I couldn't have done this. So, remember, stay safe. And crime never sleeps in South Africa. Ta-ta!